Hi, my name is Kieran O'Kane. This is the Mad Tech Podcast, the fast and furious news for the Mad Tech generation.
Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. This week was supposed to be the Glastonbury of ad tech. We were supposed to be hosting ATS London on Monday and then making our way to Cologne for the biggest trade show in the industry, Demexco. Neither of those two things have happened. Demexco, of course, is going ahead virtually, but it's just not the same thing. Who remembers Barney Vallely's last year? Who remembers possibly being stranded outside Barney Vallely's last year? Who remembers maybe observing from a distance a little ways down the street as the police arrived due to crowd control issues and had to shut Barney Vallely's down because maybe you'd invited a few too many people? Anyway, as a nod to the nostalgia that we've been feeling at Exchange Wire due to the time of year, we did two things this week. Firstly, we recorded a highlight reel of ATS London footage dating back to 2009. It's long, but it's completely worth the investment and time for the comedy gags alone, and it can be found on our website. Second is that we were delighted to be able to host live in-person panel discussion session broadcast live from our offices in Farringdon, socially distanced, of course. The basis for the discussion for that session was an article that Kieran published on exchangewire.com last week called Nine Wild Predictions for 2021, complete with probability ratings in steins. Anyone familiar with Kieran, ATS London, to Mexico this time of year will know that this is when he normally produces his predictions for the next year piece, and he likes to add a few German-themed, beery levels of predictability. Of course, all highly caveated. Anyway, we're going to share the audio of that panel discussion session with you as the podcast for this week. Panelists were Fiona Davis, COO for Captify, Anthony Rind, industry veteran in experience, not age, and most recently, formerly COO of digital agency Beamly, our very own Kieran O'Kane, and all brought together and ably moderated by my MadTech podcast co-host, Lindsay Rountree. You can see the video footage and the full panel session by visiting our website, exchangewire.com. But in the meantime, sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to this, our, what are we calling this? Not ATS London, MadTech webcast.
Mini ATS
event. And I'm delighted to be joined by, in the office physically, and then also we have virtually. So I'm gonna go virtually first. Fiona, hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you guys?
Good. So you can't be with us today because?
I'm self-isolating because I went to Spain week before last, and so I'm going to stay in the house for 2 weeks, unfortunately, but there we go. It was worth it for a bit of sunshine lying by the pool.
I totally get that. And then to my left, I have Mr. Anthony Rind. Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. Great to have you here. And then, finally, Exchange Wire CEO Kieran O'Kane.
Hello, Lindsay.
And this would have been the kickoff to the greatest week in ad tech. ATS London was due to happen today, and then Demexco the rest of the week.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously we're all ATS London veterans. Both Anthony and Fiona have both been panellists and moderated for us over the years. So
highlights of both our careers.
Definitely. I feel like the reason that you are where you are now is because of ATS London.
It is the platform that everything is founded upon.
So the premise of this is to discuss, you know, what an interesting, and I'll give you diplomatic here, interesting year this has been so far, what we expect to happen in 2021, if you could even attempt to predict that, and also go through this wonderfully divisive piece that Kieran wrote recently, the nine wild predictions for 2021 for MadTech. First of all, what did you guys think of Kieran's predictions? Were there any that stood out as being absolutely insane? And were there some that you thought, yeah, I think that could be legitimate? Fiona, I'm going to start with you.
Kieran's predictions are always crazy. No, I was he gave the same prediction last year about Google, actually. about that they were going to sell off their ad tech business, et cetera. I actually think they won't sell it until they're absolutely forced to, because it's worth a lot of money to them and allows them to tie all of their tech together. In a way that pretty much nobody can, but also the industry kind of needs them, whether they want to admit to it or not, in terms of like having someone responsible and driving certain agendas in the marketplace, even though we all hate it and we don't like them doing it, the ad tech industry is notoriously shit at organizing alternative solutions ourselves. So how many times have we had a crack at, you know, solving the ID space problem as a conglomerate of industry? We're just like really terrible at it. And I think, you know, as much as we hate the way they sometimes operate, I can't imagine the ad tech ecosystem without them in it.
Anthony, what do you think the future of Google looks like?
So to simplify, I think let's bracket that always the double click bit, even though they don't use that. I think...
They obviously decided to merge it all together to make it really even harder to unpick when they were forced to sell it.
Right. Yeah. I think there's two reasons we look at the landscape. There isn't anything close to double click in terms of its scope of capability. There isn't a single close competitor. A couple of companies have come close and fallen away. And that's, it's a real problem for the industry. It's actually a massive risk that if the separation of DoubleClick from Google leads to a denigration of capability of DoubleClick, I think that puts the industry further backwards. And in some ways, the ability to use data at a user level or have confidence in the application of signals through an execution stack by decoupling Google and DoubleClick, I think could be put at risk. I think that's a problem. Part of the reason that there isn't enough competition to DoubleClick end-to-end solution is that obviously the subsidy of DoubleClick system pricing because of Google's broader revenue position has held back competition. So if we look for positives, it could mean that there's a more effective pricing opportunity for people to come and compete.
Yeah.
But there's a massive risk for the industry if the ability of DoubleClick to give a solution is compromised, because we do have a lot of non-interoperable point solutions.
And that's an interesting point, is the interoperability of this, because actually taking DoubleClick out of the mix or making them separate, just it will set the industry back, is what you're saying, basically. And we'll have to start again. That there's no end-to-end solution, these touch points that can't mix together. Kieran, you're doubling down on this prediction.
It's going to happen.
Right.
It's going to happen, right? DoubleClick isn't going away, right? So what's going to happen right now is Google is under the cosh everywhere. In the US, in Europe, they have to do something here, right? So they're going to make a sacrifice of a certain part of the business. They want to hold on to YouTube. They want to hold on to Google Search. They want to hold on to Google Cloud. They want to hold on to Chrome. These are high margin, high growth products,
and
right?
Android as a platform.
And Android, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Android. These are the crown jewels for Google, right? Display is just a nice business. It's not high margin. It's a nice business. They make 20 billion, but they're only making like, what, 20, 30% on that. I mean, that's a lot of money, but it's not enough for Google. And the growth is starting to stagnate, right? So I'm not saying that DoubleClick's going away. I'm saying that Google would spin it out as a separate business to a PE firm. Google will still benefit from that business in some shape or form. But I just don't think it's enough just to kind of tinker. I think the tinker days are finished. Google have so much power in this industry. I can be saying it for 10 years. So much power. And I know that Fiona's point is right. But we are addicted to Google heroin, right? We need to go cold turkey, right? And if it hits the industry a couple of points in terms of growth, that's good enough, because Google's not there anymore. Think about it, right? An independent DoubleClick stack with AdSense and all the rest as a separate business, Google loses focus, right? It's decoupled from the mothership. The PE firm just rinses it for money for three or four years. That is a huge opportunity for ad tech to take control, right? This all feeds into Google's view of the world, right? They play three-dimensional chess. We don't even play chess. We're checkers. That's what we do. We're dumb compared to Google, right? There are five moves ahead of us, right? What do we need to do to get legislators off our back, to get antitrust off our back? And this is going to be one of the ways to do it.
So
cut my arm off, save myself, you know?
This is why we don't have Kieran as a panellist rather than moderator. Shut up. And I must remind you guys, everyone watching, there will be a Q&A at the end. So if you have any questions, please message us through the Zoom function, whatever it is, and I will make sure I get around to it and answer as many as possible. But Fiona, to your point, you know, you said if anything were to happen with DoubleClick, it would take a couple of years for us to get to that stage for anything to happen. But say that DoubleClick was spun off out of Google tomorrow, in its current state, would ad tech be able to cope?
Well, I mean, the obvious thing here, right, is we haven't really touched on is what they're doing with the browser is actually way more important, because the cookie, according to Google, is going away at the end of next year anyway. So if you spin out DoubleClick, that just becomes yet another third-party pixel fire to gather information. So actually, it almost kills the entire model out of the gate. You know, at least in the Google environment, it's deemed one of their first party. So, and as a third party measurement tool, it's almost been deprecated already. So it's actually more important what they're going to be doing with the Chrome approach and what the rest of the browsers do, because once the cookie goes away, you're back to using either some kind of cohorts, interest-based group type solution, an ID-based solution. So it's already changing the landscape anyway. The rest of the industry is already moving on to what are we doing in a cookieless world, where Google's still an incredibly powerful player because they have one of the most used browsers in the world. And you know, if they're not engaged with the ad tech community because they sold off their business, that can only be bad for all of us, because they're already struggling to get agreement in the ad tech community about how that the new cohort system's even going to work. There's no agreement, and we're already, what, September? And that's supposed to be available sometime next year. You know, we've got bigger problems than whether or not they're going to spin off DoubleClick.
I think if we try and take a positive, if someone's going to buy DoubleClick, they're going to want to have some confidence in what they're buying, having a medium-term future. So one would assume that whoever buys it will insist upon some continuation of data from Google.
They'll want assurances. Yeah.
But what that might lead to is a leadership team of the spun out entity that has a greater interest in collaboration with other systems and other entities. Mm. So hopefully it could lead to, actually, we know that there are a lot of very smart people in the DoubleClick structure actually being able to be far more innovative and aggressive at creating an ecosystem that is broader than Google but still has an interoperability with Google. So
are you saying they can't be innovative inside Google, these wonderful people that Google employs?
I'm sure they are very innovative, but against the strategy of making Google much stronger as an independent entity than necessarily creating the landscape. But again, we mustn't also ignore some of the other signals that are going on. We've seen just in the last couple of weeks Oracle withdrawing from Europe around the data marketplace. Again, this, I think, is indicative of a broader problem that we have, and we can refer to the much amusing hype curves. I think the what used to be called a consumer data platform, or before that a DMP, and sometimes now a CIP, whatever acronym is du jour, is something that a lot of brands have spent money to invest into and not necessarily seeing the return that they wanted. So maybe if we do get to a world where there is DoubleClick outside of Google embracing interoperability, I hope, that might lead to the growth again of the understanding of why it's worth investing in data as an asset to manage your first-party data and enrich it, which I think a lot of companies bought into strategically but executionally found a lot harder than they anticipated and are now sort of wondering about the value of continuing to invest in. If Trump gets a second term, he is going to very aggressively protect American companies in the global marketplace. And if someone can convince him that breaking up Google is not going to be helpful to their position globally, I'm not sure he will allow that to happen. He doesn't seem to mind if he takes a populist decision, regardless of what he's been advised around him. And poking the noses of other politicians and due process is something he's very comfortable doing. I think a breakup isn't necessarily that obvious if Trump stays in.
I don't think it's coming from the US. I think it's coming from the EU. I think the EU's meant to pass new laws that gives them more powers to kick companies at the European Union. The balkanization of the global ad market is happening from China to the EU to the US. It's happening right now. And we'll talk about him later on, but that TikTok decision has changed the rules.
I can see Kieran getting angry and angry. The European versus US conversation is an interesting one, and it ties in with another of your predictions, Kieran, which was that you believe that the EU will always be disintermediated when it comes to US ad tech. They'll skip over us and they'll go to APAC. And we've actually had conversations directly with ad tech companies that have basically admitted to doing just that, and largely it's been regulation based, legal based, but it's often easier for them to be able to copy what their protocol is, copy what their process and their product is in the US, and translate that better to an APAC environment than they can in the EU at the moment. The EU feels like too much work. So, but I mean, I've seen some people are dead, think you're dead wrong on this, that the EU will be kind of left out of US ad tech. but there are others that probably think that there's something to this. I'm interested in your thoughts on this as well, Anto and Fiona. Fiona, I'm going to start with you. Where do you think the EU's position is in ad tech, in global ad tech?
I actually think that Kieran's right in that their newer entrants to the market, or somewhere that that part of their business is not doing that well, they're making, like Oracle, for instance, is making a strategic decision that we're not making enough money to justify the pain in the butt that it is to operate in Europe, so we're going to remove ourselves. But yet, like, a trade desk is not going to pull out of Europe, right? It's a massive market for them. And I think what you'll see is most of the larger companies that have actually got it together when it comes to GDPR, they're global, right? So they've strategically over the last 10 years been building out their footprints in all parts of the world, and already have accepted that they're the risks of working in the European marketplace and are working towards that. It depends on the ad tech company as well. If you're a straight data company, you'd be asking yourself some serious questions in Europe. But if you're one of the trading desks, or if you're like a measurement company or something like that, you're obviously still going to be wanting to operate. It's a large market. So I don't think it's necessarily going to be, no, we're not operating there at all. But I do think that there is space for more innovation from Europe, from European-based companies that have that sort of GDPR privacy-first stuff at their core. And there will be opportunity for people to operate in the European market, where certain European clients really would prefer to work with a European vendor.
I think it also depends where a company is in its growth trajectory.
Yes, really.
I think that a company that's looking for fast growth is not going to view Europe as the place to grow quickly, because it's such a fragmented marketplace with high degree of friction. It's easier to grow by going from New York to Dallas than going from New York to London, because the local marketplaces in parts of the US are so much stronger. There is also an opportunity for many of the Asian markets to operate in hubs. There is a much more of a consistent structure of cross-market regional hubs. So again, I think the growth opportunity is there. Europe is a challenge because it has very localized markets, complicated markets, and also regulatory constraints. However, any of the global ad tech and data companies that operate in Europe can take the learnings from Europe into the US, because the US regulations are following the European model.
Absolutely.
And the Asian model is further behind again. So again, I think fast growth, capital pressure companies, Europe isn't the place where they're going to return on the investment quickly enough to keep their investors happy. They'll go elsewhere. But at some point, if they want to have a global footprint and demonstrate that they operate in the best possible standards, Europe is where they have to operate.
And do you think that US regulation, being not that far behind EU regulation now, actually represents an opportunity for European ad tech that's already got its ducks in a row when it comes to data and privacy regulation, to be able to actually expand into the US, where the US companies are probably scrabbling about trying to work out how they can continue? Is there opportunity there, Kieran? What do you think?
I think on the data ID side, they've already proved that they've carved out a particularly interesting niche.
They have, absolutely.
Look at InfoSum and Zeotap and all those amazing companies that have just spread it up because the regulations in Europe have been so draconian and hardcore that they just had to evolve their model, right? And, you know, I'm going to overuse this word balkanization again of the ID space. You're going to have multiple players in that space that are going to have to figure out how you sort of like do measurement, targeting, attribution, all the rest. These are very important pieces. Like, so you see InfoSum, who just basically raised a bunch of money and have Brian Lesser on the board, and you know they're going after, it looks like they're going after the CTV space, and I think they're going to be an interesting player there, maybe in the measurement space. Zeotap, like onboarding, but sort of more advanced than LiveRamp in terms of the privacy piece, and Permanent, if we talked about it, like Novity. But yeah, there's definitely a trend to see European companies do that. But coming back to the original question, right, there's a very interesting case going on in in Dublin right now between Facebook and Mr. Schrems, who is an Austrian data
Max
privacy
Schrems.
Yeah. Max Schrems. And he's basically talked about the data shield, right, that you cannot transport or transfer data between Europe and the US. And Facebook are really going hard in this case, because effectively they'd have to spin out two separate companies, because they'll have to store the data within Europe, right? So a lot of ad tech companies have to consider that, right?
Well, everybody.
That's a huge thing. That was my point. global business, sure, they'll stay here.
Because they're already there.
Because it's 400 million people. Yeah, that's huge.
I guess with the US, and Fiona O'Reilly said it, but you know, it's easy to, if you're in New York, often you actually forget what on your own doorstep, and the ability to spin out into these other hubs that are across the United States actually presents a big opportunity that you haven't tapped into yet, versus going, I'm going to go straight to Europe.
You look at the likes of some of the ad networks at Captify and who have built massive businesses in the US because they've realised the value of the non-New York markets. Like, there's huge spend in Florida for mattress companies and alligator parks and what the hell are they doing there, like, you know, golf courses and the like. It's just a crazy spend. I'm just saying that Europe is clearly an opportunity, but my point is it's just become harder and harder. And with these data regulations and with Brexit, like, so you move to London, now you've got to figure out how you can operate in Europe. I know, but at the minute it's seamless, but once a hard Brexit comes, it'll be very difficult. Yeah. So then you've got to say, do I set up an office in London? Do I set up an office in Dublin? I mean, it's not cheap to hire people in Dublin. It's not cheap at all. So you've got to consider all those. And that was my point.
Yeah, and I think you've seen quite a few American companies that have just withdrawn out of the US, the European market, because it is hard.
Yeah.
And they've just gone back to where we can just double down on the US market and make more money here. And definitely to Kira's point, like, we've, you know, growing the business in the US because the scale of the market is massive, right? And if you have a good product, people want to buy from you and they want alternatives. And I agree with you that I think it's much harder to start a business in Europe. Then if you're already here and you already know the landscape and you've already got a footprint, and you know, it's that realization that it's not like a continent that you've just got to fix it once and Bob's your uncle. It's like a conglomerate of a load of different countries, all with different legislation and different way of doing business as well. So that comes with long experience. So it's only companies that have been here a long time that are in all of those markets that know the difference between the German market and the Netherlands and know that there is, you know, not a one-size-fits-all for Europe anyway.
But I think we also have to recognise that there's been quite a lot of the companies that have launched into our space that are building duplicative tech because they're more interested in a valuation model that's tech-based than actually building a service-based business. And I think that's something that if people are starting businesses now, which I think a lot of people will be coming out of the current
situation,
is that there's so much tech in the marketplace that people have sunk money into that can be utilized.
Mm.
And with a very good service model,
you can do well.
You can do really, really well. And the agility of that, the speed of that, frankly, within Europe, the lack of country barriers is a huge opportunity. There is always space for good service, as we're seeing from all of the trends around in-housing or specialist agencies, Sir Martin Sorrell's innovation of the marketplace.
So you're saying we need more ad networks. Well said, Andy.
We need more service providers.
It's absolutely true. People want service. Like, shockingly, you would think that people would be doubling down on more, we want a clean ecosystem, transparent, blah, blah, blah. Reality is people want service and they want differentiation around insights and trends, and someone who can actually make sense of the ecosystem for them is super undervalued.
Yeah,
because it's all PowerPoint promise.
But Europeans do that really well. Like, look, they do it really well. And that's evidenced by the great sort of, you know, managed service business we have in the continent.
I want to get all of your thoughts on Kieran's prediction that Zander would be bought by a European consortium.
Yeah.
Yeah. To allow it to thrive in Europe, where there is massive, massive need for a company like Zander. So I'm really keen to get everyone's thoughts. And you get that a 4 out of 5 Steins. So you feel like you're fairly confident that that's going to happen.
I mean, I might be drinking also, the Steins at the same time as Brighton article, it looks like.
It does feel that way. It does feel that way. It was a very positive.
I want to know, Kieran, whether or not you're trying to get funding for that. Like, is it something you're personally involved in right now?
I just think it's a good idea. I mean, what's so different from all the crazy ideas we've seen this year? Like, you know, TikTok being bought by Oracle. That happened.
And in fact, at ATS London last year, you and Andrew Casale were on stage saying, well, you first of all said that you thought Chrome would get sold, and you said that you would buy it. But also, you both said you did not think that Google would denigrate third-party cookies. Don't believe it's going to happen. It's not going to happen. They won't do that. Unless they really force it, they won't do it. And then four or five months later... Yeah, exactly. So the beauty of ad tech is it's as predictable as it is unpredictable.
I'll just give you a basis of what I thought, but I would like to hear other people's opinion. But the basis of that was it was off the back of my... See, prediction two only happens if prediction one happens, right? So, like, if Google do this rollout or spin out, it's going to leave a vacuum in the space, right? And there isn't really... There's a couple of scale plays on the buy side and sell side, but AppNexus was one of those, right, globally, that were competing. And then they sold to AT&T. And I feel that AT&T just don't care anymore. That's what the article's saying anyway. Like, they want to spin it out. And why wouldn't a European consortium buy it, given the fact that it's got the strongest play here on the sell side among European publishers?
Do the publishers work better with DoubleClick outside of Google than they ever have done with it inside of Google? So actually, is the marketplace opportunity for AppNexus of old diminished by an independent DoubleClick?
Because AppNexus, particularly in Europe, and if you look at Germany especially, AppNexus is always the non-Google.
Yeah.
For those who do not want, it's a bit like ad servers, Flash Talking is always the non-Google ad server. So actually, if it's no longer part of Google, will people want it? That's a really interesting point.
And the other difficult question is, how strong is the Xandr technology? Because it sat within Group M for a long time and certainly got the benefit, I'm sure. It's been in AT&T. So again, what's the synergy from that? And what's happened to all of the people that drove AppNexus before that? Have they all retired, moved on, started their next venture, sit on a beach somewhere? So is the acquisition a shell that all of the intellectual capital has left behind? Mm. Why would you buy it?
First of all, other than your idea that a consortium of people would buy them, I mean, there's not that many people left to buy an ad stack. And there are already alternatives to Google in Europe now. So you don't have to be using AppNexus. There's other ad servers still in the market that you can use.
Are you backtracking on this?
I'm still four stines. I still think it's going to happen.
But less,
ring me
less
Terry.
Buy side.
Terry Quadra, ring me.
I want to get your thoughts on, because with the beauty of Anthony and Fiona is that we've got a wealth of ad tech agency consultancy.
Fiona more than me.
Okay, the beauty, the physical
truly
beauty.
The beauty and the beast.
That's you.
That's me.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, among us, we have a wealth of agency, ad tech, consultancy and brand within that experience as well. The interesting that Kieran, and we've been talking about this for many, many years at ATS London, is the future of the agency holding model. And actually, there's been talk about it being dead, then it's alive again, then it's dead again, then it's recovering, then it's dying. And you believe that actually this hype about it being dead is hyperbole, and it's not actually true. You still stand by that?
Yeah.
You backtrack
again? I agree with that.
So I want to get...
I didn't see Wilson poison me for 10 years. Like,
you never listened to it.
The thing is, I started off thinking, oh yeah, programmatic's going to kill them. But then you just realise that they're resilient. organizations, like, you know, most of their capability is the people that work around them, right? They don't have any, you know, infrastructure costs. Well, some of them don't, but it's about the talent within the group, and then it's the global footprint they can do as well, right? It's the ability to do global buys, and in this part of the world, you have to have that expertise, like, so in-housing works to a certain extent, but when you need to do those big sort of marketing campaigns globally, agencies are just, holding groups are in a great position to do that. And that's what I mean by the resilience. Okay, COVID has probably hit them pretty hard, like everybody else. We're all taking hits. But they'll come back because they're built to survive.
They're incredibly Darwinistic organizations. They always offer the services that their clients want. And they will consistently evolve the service offering. They're very good at almost second step innovation. Agencies don't tend to be the originators, but what they then do is buy companies that bring them into the organization, promote the leaders of those innovating companies into leadership roles to help accelerate the change of the holding company. 20 years ago, holding companies were smaller and were creatively dominant. They then went through a media dominant phase. They're now in a digitally dominant phase. Mm. They will continue evolving. The next phase obviously will be e-commerce and e-retail. Yeah. That's the next wave.
And the more fragmentation.
I think the big thing that's going to challenge them though in the next year is the human side of recovering from work from home, the separation of teams, the hiring freezes because they are incredibly P&L driven. Mm-hmm. So what's happening at the moment is that teams are stretched. The billings under management are diminishing, but the amount of work required isn't because it takes just as much time to do a campaign of half the size. Mm-hmm. So the teams are stretched. They're not sitting with each other, so you can't see where the breakpoints are. So people are suffering. Campaigns are taking longer, and they're going to be impacted. And I think there's going to be a real human cost that the companies involved, both the advertiser and the agency leadership, are going to think about how to ensure that the people managing the day-to-day get through this cycle, because I think there's a lot of difficulties that are hidden by the work-from-home situation.
It's not just about the ad tech. It's about the entire service packaging an agency offers to a client. And clients, more than ever this year, are trying to navigate through the entire ad ecosystem changing and cookies going away, and they need advice from other people. And that, you know, some very sophisticated brands will already have technical teams and analytics teams in-house that can do that for them, but the vast majority of them don't. So they have to rely on someone for that advice, and it tends to be the bigger agencies. And I think to your point, Kieran, about the holding companies, they're the only ones with deep enough pockets to be able to necessarily survive the COVID onslaught, because it is impacting people's, you know, P&Ls at the moment, hiring freezes, that kind of stuff. And it is going to be tough for everybody to, you know, trade out of that and navigate through that. But at the end of the day, they still have a service that clients want. Brands want help with brand advertising, not just programmatic. It's a more of a holistic kind of approach to it. And I actually do think with all of this stuff with cookies, what will end up happening is a lot of people will go back to some of the more traditional brand advertising, and that you already see, like, so much video is being bought, so much audio, and it's much more brand level metrics than it is DR these days. So you'll still have DR, you'll still have that digital kind of ecosystem, but there's a lot more brands who are rethinking the way they're positioning themselves and where they're spending their money, and they're going to need agencies to do that because they don't typically have that skill set in-house unless they're a very large organization with a huge ad team.
And you keep talking about service, you've all mentioned service, and we do refer to the agency layer as the service layer. Do you think that this is, at this time, is the agencies should be doubling down on service, as we spoke about earlier, and actually not looking so deep into buying tech and trying to own their own tech, but actually using the tech that's already out there and saying, this is where we excel, this is where our heritage is, we need to be giving the service that everyone needs?
I think
it's going to be a combo of both, right? Isn't it? Wouldn't you say? Because you have to have good ad model in the first place, like a good buying model and the right prices for your ad tech, so that you're not, you know, killing your own business in the process. But I mean, definitely on our side, we found that the thing that people wanted most from us in the last two quarters is trends and insights, because the whole buying landscape is changing underneath them, and they're like, oh my God, where do I spend my money now? And so, you know, we do buying, selling of media, but actually what they want to know from us is, where are people now? What are they searching? What are they looking for? And it's that kind of immediacy and change of stuff where they're just looking for someone to tell them this is what's actually happening in the industry right now. So it's not just a simple matter of having a good buying model for them.
The one thing I would say that feeds into this is that fragmentation is the agency's friend, right? It's a feckin' mess right now, right? If you think about deprecation of cookies, right, the amount of media platforms out there. This is not just only opportunity for holding groups. I agree that there's a bit of an economic downturn coming, which probably will benefit the holding groups. But it's below that as well. I believe that you're going to have a lot of, you know, companies are helping the agencies as well, right? Figure this out, right? So, you know, the managed service, but how do I figure this out from a client point of view? But they're going to be leaning on new companies coming to the space. Mm-hmm. I'm very optimistic about this. I think consolidation is, you know, whatever, this fragmentation is bad for you. I think it's great because you're going to get lots of entrepreneurial companies popping up who will say, you know what, I can figure out how to do measurement across iOS. I have a vertical ad network. I've got this specific audience on a first party basis, right? There is huge opportunity for ad networks, point solution, ad tech companies to work with the holding groups, to work with independent agencies. I think this is going to be a great time because clients who if anything, programmatic was the enemy of the agency group, right? But with this fragmentation in programmatic now, right, it's getting harder to in-house, you know, the holistic media buy, right? It's just going to be impossible. So they're going to be leaning on the agencies to help to figure this out. And this is where, You know, this is where Accenture thought they could fill this gap, but Accenture can't media buy for Adam. They're just, you know, here's my PowerPoint, as this man would say, give me $1 million. So I don't want to get my hands dirty. So this is the opportunity for agencies to manage a lot of that. And it has a massive knock-on effect down the line. I think this is a brilliant, this could be, the next deck is going to be really interesting. The fragmentation thing is our friend, really, and I'm quite excited about it.
Again, I think I agree with you broadly, but obviously what we're referring to as programmatic, let's broaden it out as much, which is any platform managed media is probably a good percentage of digital, and digital is now a good percentage of total media. But media, again, is only a relatively small bit of the overall comms management piece. So the agencies are delivering a much more holistic service, that this is part of the deployment phase, and often actually quite removed from the brand team themselves, because they're the specialist team over there that do it for us. And part of that was because it was technical, not necessarily very strategic, and for many brand teams, not their day-to-day concern. So there's a degree of removal there. But one thing I would say at the moment, if you look at the last couple of recessions, what's happened straight afterwards is a lot of brands have then called global media reviews. So there's been a massive tranche of pitching, which has got to a point where the agencies have fought very hard to retain or win business at often dreadful commercial terms. And that's led to a cycle of fallout, because then the agencies haven't been able to deliver the service required or even the price guarantees required. And there's been the lack of transparency in a number of instances. So again, what I'm hoping is that this doesn't follow that same cycle, that the brands say, well, how do I save 10% from my budget because our business is in trouble? Right, I'm going to hammer the agencies and cut their fees and have a pitch to see whether or not I can get something better. Because that will actually detract from all of the innovation and the change that we all think will be really exciting to come out of this, because it's going to lead to a very ugly, commercially focused process, taking a lot of time and potentially slowing down that improvement of the commercial model that we know is actually the biggest weakness of the holding company, is the commercial model that they're operating under.
From your experience, particularly, Anthony, is there a right or wrong approach here? Because there's, I mean, I worked at agency land during a recession, and what the company that I worked for did the pay freeze, and the other big company did the opposite. And all the senior people at my company said we should have done the opposite, because they actually could easily have cut 20% of the chaff from the wheat and actually had a better, more lean, more efficient business model. Is there going to be a lot of conversations about what the optimum solution here is?
Oh, I mean, if you're running a P&L, you have to try and get to at least break even.
Yeah, of course.
Unless somebody more senior in the organization says, I'm prepared to tolerate this amount of loss this year, you will absolutely look at your cost base and trim, which could be a combination of, normally it's not hiring positions that are open. So that's a natural way of saving money, is if someone leaves the company, you don't replace them.
Yeah.
The bonuses are all discretionary, so there's a cushion there that allows you to not cut. Mm-hmm. And if necessary, you'll restructure. And then it's a question, do I get rid of someone expensive, or do I get rid of five people that are cheaper? And invariably, what will happen is that you'll thin at the top, and then you'll allow space for the next generation to come through, because what you're telling them is you need to accept the challenging situation of working very hard, not necessarily getting a pay cut, because there's a career opportunity here for you to fill the void. So ideally, you organically protect the organization, you accelerate the ability for the organization to change and gain through the experience. Because our business on the media side is invariably linked to commission, because you don't know what's going to happen to media spends, you have to be conservative, again, to try and ensure that you're managing responsibly the business to the P&L. So if what happens, which again happened in 2009, 2010, yeah, was we all anticipated the recession then to lead to reduction in spend, and it did broadly, but digital grew massively. Mm-hmm. So what happened actually was many digital businesses were markedly profitable in 2009 and 10 because they didn't anticipate the growth.
Yeah.
They'd restructured the business cost base, expecting a challenging time, and the business picked up. So it depends how responsive the company can be. Mm. So it's not just as easy as saying, I'm going to invest in my people, I'm going to cut my costs. You've got to be allowed to do that by whoever is running the business above your P&L separation. And you've got to try and keep as much control as possible in your cost base to respond negatively and positively to the unknowns of how much is this client going to spend, or is this client going to find me, or will I win a new piece of business that wants to spend quickly?
Interesting. And Fiona, what responsibility do brands have in this, in ensuring they are not cutting their nose off to spite their face when it comes to the partnerships and the relationships they're trying to maintain through all of this?
I think it's been really interesting actually watching them react. In the first couple of months when COVID first hit, like March, April, everyone kind of freaked out a bit and froze all of their spend because no one knew what was going to happen. And then after a couple of months, people realised that, you know, the show kind of needed to go on, and so they started spending again. And I think what they've done is taken the opportunity, like most businesses, of just taking a bit of a step back and doing a reevaluation about, well, who are my strategic partners and what do I want to get out of this relationship? And it's actually changed the conversation to be, I think, a bit less about rates and more about what's in it for me for this long-term partnership, and can I remove some of the partners that I'm not really getting that much value out of? And I don't mean value in terms of dollars. I mean, what else can you provide me that helps me kind of drive my business forward and are you kind of still fit for the new ecosystems?
I think another interesting factor at the moment is that the context we're in has focused a lot of minds on what's working, what isn't, what do I need to change about my business? So I think on one end, no brand can ignore e-retail and e-commerce anymore. A lot of people have said, no, that's, I've got a team that do that, but I'm thinking about my brand and I'm thinking about my what I'm saying to my consumers. The growth of direct consumer e-commerce platforms and the need to have a coherent presence across all touch points, your e-retail side of things, means that even CPG, FMCG companies now absolutely understand that e-commerce is the foundation of growth. The question mark is, what does that do for attribution and measurement? Because again, in theory, that gives much more of a closed loop to data to say, I'm spending on brand and I can actually track a greater percentage now through a partner or through my own conversion tracking methodology.
Yeah, right.
So again, the quality of the first party data is improving and is growing. And that's actually highlighting a lot of the inconvenient components of friction around that. So again, I'm hoping that out of this, we're going to get a much more strategic structured approach.
Talking about, Lindsay, about different media types, right? So audio is getting a spike now because more people are listening in that environment in at home or wherever they are remotely. And also CTV. There's clients now that would never have been buying CTV 6 months ago that are all doubling down on streaming services now. So there's a whole range of different kind of behaviours from the brands on where they see best brand coverage. And this is why, like, particularly CPG brands, they need much more real-time information about how people's spending behaviour has changed, not just because it's gone online, but actually where they're buying and what types of products they're buying is changing as well. So it's very... it's kind of made them rethink almost their whole media strategy and what type of media they're buying.
I want to ask you guys kind of what role politics is now playing in this in a way that it never probably is more intrinsically tied to ad tech and the future of the digital media industry than probably ever has before. And if the whole TikTok saga in the US proves anything, it proves that anything, you know, no one knows what could happen, anything could happen. What are there any big things in 2021 that you think could come off the back of this?
There's one I'm really conscious of, and it's slightly non-industry, it's slightly more social really, but it has, I think, major implications for our industry, and that's the BBC. We've got a situation, it was about a week ago, it was announced that the sale of BBC licenses, and it's very UK, but the sale of BBC licenses has fallen dramatically. It's 250,000 less, it's the biggest drop in license sales.
Yeah.
That's ever been seen, because obviously people are under financial pressure. Many younger groups don't watch TV in the same way. So even because it's streamed, they're not thinking they're watching TV.
Yep.
And you know, obviously the non-enforcement, which I think is a good thing, means that there's less concern about not paying it. Now, we also have a situation where the government is clearly not very BBC friendly. So I think we have...
Well, like the archers.
I think we have a huge risk to something that's incredibly important to us as a nation, not just from entertainment, but news, quality of news, verified outlet of news. We know that's a huge issue. And again, as the UK is being perceived globally in a different way because of some of the political decisions about treaties or projections about attitudes to other countries, the BBC is really important for how we are perceived around the world and our values. And so I'm worried about what happens to the BBC. And I think for our industry, if the government decides that an ad-funded model is what's needed, then that's going to have a massive impact on ITV and on Channel 4 and all of the other channels because there's going to be a total step change in supply of inventory that will massively damage the business models of all of the media. At a time we know that content is not something that advertising is appropriately covering the cost of in many instances. So I think that's something that in the next year is going to be a major factor.
If you aren't in the UK and you're wondering what we're referring to as licenses, in the UK, our public television, BBC, we pay a an annual license of £170 or whatever it is to access that television. And so Anthony's saying that the people are no longer buying those licenses.
There's a trend
of people not buying licenses for many different reasons, because they decided not to watch BBC anymore, or they're streaming it and don't think they need to. It could cause a complete 180 in how the BBC in the UK is funded, because the BBC obviously is ad funded everywhere else.
But
in this country, if it becomes ad funded, I had not considered the impact it would have on the rest of the TV monetization in this country.
I'm going to take devil's advocate here, because Andy's been doing it to me all day. I'm going to take more of that point of view, and that the BBC distorts the landscape in terms of commercial might. I think that's fair. The BBC has been the Netflix of this country, and RTE in Ireland as well. Similarly, they're funded by the license fee. Has been sort of Netflix, and it's kind of been funded that way. And people now are going, why am I paying for this? Well, I'm paying for Netflix. I think it's a mindset change as well. I mean, the BBC is going to have to evolve around this. It already has a fairly successful commercial business abroad. I mean, there's a way to blend this business. I do agree with you that it is sort of a voice of decency in all the chaotic noise and the Facebook's the war and all the rest of the shouting match, where the BBC's had a sort of middle of the road opinion, and it's given the UK a good appeal. But I think this is going to have to evolve. I don't think it's going to be a tragedy, the collapse of the BBC. The BBC will always be there. The artists will always be there. You'll always have all those Doctor Who, whatever else he's watching TV. I don't even watch TV anymore. I don't really care. Anyway, that's the Trump, right? Trump has opened a can of worms.
Yes.
With TikTok, his banning of that app is going to basically open up a can of isolationist worms, if you will, globally. Right? What's to stop him, if he gets re-elected, to kind of start going, I don't like Facebook today, I don't like Twitter today, I don't like Google, I'll send an executive order to ban them from the US. What's to stop the EU going, you know what? Facebook and Google are not listening to us. Let's just kick them out. Let's sign a decrease and get them out of the market. Chinese, the Indians are all doing it. I think the age of like being able to scale global platforms is coming to a screeching halt right now. I'm not saying it's the end of the ability to scale globally, but again, it's that fragmentation by country. And Trump is just setting really bad precedents, right? He is literally the worst president ever for the free market. He is an isolationist because it suits his political objectives. And I think the TikTok thing is a huge can of worms. I just like Facebook, Google, and Apple and Amazon should have went to court to block them. Should have made a point going, you cannot do this. You cannot just sign an executive order banning an app. Whether or not they're sending sensitive data back to China, right, that's a good cause, but we don't know any, there's no evidence to show that, because as someone pointed out, TikTok's data centers are based outside of China, he's literally changed the script around this globalization.
And a lot of the questions that we've been receiving on the Q&A have been around, actually going forward, who knows what will next year look like, and who will be the winner, who's going to win it in all of this?
Sir Marty,
Trump.
I don't know that Trump will.
But Fiona, further on to Kieran's point about TikTok and that this setting a precedent that could be replicated in other markets across other regions. I mean, is that going to happen? And who do you think is going to ultimately win out of all of this?
I was just going to say, I think that the great irony about the whole TikTok situation is, for a country that bangs on about free speech and censorship, they basically, that was effectively the largest piece of censorship I've seen them do for a long time. I think it's a little bit more nuanced in other parts of the world, where people don't necessarily have that knee-jerk reaction about everything China does, that they're all spying on us. There is an element of that going around at the moment, but I think Europeans are a little bit more balanced in their views on that type of stuff and a little bit more open to, you know, as if Facebook hasn't been caught red-handed doing way worse than TikTok. And so I think you're going to find people being a little bit less, you know, mental about it here. But still at the same time, even our own government in the UK and in Australia, heavily influenced by the US, if they want to stay in good partnership with them, will tend to get dragged down that kind of road. So I do think it is, it'll be interesting to see, A, whether he wins the next election, and B, whether this is the precedent for them just blocking anyone that isn't an American company. I think what you would find, though, is if that's the route they're going to start going down and trying to own the entire marketplace by doing that kind of stuff, you'll definitely see people starting to diverge away from US-owned platforms, and you'll see more competition coming into the market.
That's interesting.
You see it already. There's loads of new apps coming out where people are, you know, leaving Facebook in their droves, that are not happy with the direction of the product and the way the ads are being placed, that type of stuff. And, you know, you're already seeing other platforms competing with YouTube pretty effectively now, like VLive and all of that stuff is getting huge traction in the marketplace. It's largely outside of the US kind of ecosystem. So there's lots of other stuff going on.
We are basically out of time, but we're
No more questions.
We're well over time. It's been going on for over an hour. Do you know that?
I know, but I'm enjoying it, though. We haven't done an ATS probably... since
Do we not go till 6 o'clock?
Is
that a bonus question?
Listen, I'm happy to carry on chatting.
Is there a bonus question? Beers coming in later.
Where's the bonus question? There should be the bonus
question.
There's
no bonus question. We're out of time. What? I asked you, who's going to win?
All we can say is it's going to be messy, right? Chaos. I mean, this is the messiest I've ever seen it. It's just going to get worse.
Well, I just think nothing's going to happen until February. We're in a limbo situation.
Yeah. No, we're in a holding
Christmas
pattern.
Christmas is cancelled.
We're in a holding pattern at the moment.
Christmas is cancelled.
Christmas is cancelled. Hanukkah is cancelled. We're just going to be in a stasis. We're on lockdown, apparently. I just had a text message. We're all in lockdown. We can't leave it. We're in this for 2 weeks. Get the sleep bags out.
Oh,
get some cocoa. Watch some few Netflix.
Two meters.
Wow. Okay. I mean,
made the right decision not to come into the office.
Yeah. Exactly. You never know what Kieran's got.
Yeah. Canned beans. I think I've got some sausages in the beans. Cans.
Yeah,
I think we need to stop now.
Yeah, I'm going to end it there, and I'm not even going to say any final words.
Let's stop now.
Wow, that is a way to end it. I want to say thank you so much to all our listeners for joining us today, and thank you to Fiona all the way from wherever you are in your kitchen.
So
Anthony, thank you, and Kieran.
Thanks.
I think.
If you want to hear more news and opinions from ExchangeWire or our other brands, the gaming economy and fast growth brands, you can subscribe to our newsletters at exchangewire.com, thegamingeconomy.com and fastgrowthbrands.com. Thanks for listening.